recorded.
All right. Now, were you asking me that because there was something that you wanted to reference tonight?
Okay.
Or were you asking me whether I just got it in general?
No, specifically.
Oh, specifically.
Okay, good evening, everybody. It's Wednesday night, and it's 7 o'clock here on the west coast of the United States. We are in the midst, actually at the beginning, of the study of a particular book. This is our fourth book that we're doing in this format, actually online, in Gorbeck TV. And we've done several of his other books. This one is called The Hidden Work. And there's actually been a genesis of the process where we've gone through the very basic work, and I think really an introductory text, which takes a great deal of work, I'm not going to say that, which is the human biological machine as a transformational apparatus, lovingly referred to as HBM. Mm-hmm. And we've done practical work on self, and then we've also done joyous sacrifice, and then a few months ago we finished Life in the Labyrinth. HBM and Life in the Labyrinth are considered to be two of a three-part series. And the third part, which was introduced in the form of photographs of Bardotown, and it's actually an interesting format, and only one person ever purchased that. I myself have a copy in addition to that person, but yes, they're very effective. But from a certain point of view, I also consider The Hidden Work to be the third part of that series. Because in the third part of the series, it says, okay, we've already understood a bit about how to awaken the machine. And in Life in the Labyrinth, we talk in detail about being in the essential self space. So now in The Hidden Work, we're taking it to another level. We're saying, okay, now that we're agreeing about that hidden space, the labyrinth, exists, and that's our true home in a sense, we're saying, okay, what are the mechanics of living in that space? And we're on chapter 3. And do you want to get us going, M.A., then?
Sure. Chapter 3, Elshana. The oldest form of prayer is not supplication. It is a means of helping the absolute, and the means by which we can absolve ourselves of original sin. We should think of prayer absolute as fulfilling our obligation as human beings.
Thank you. And Hawk Lady, I'm not sure, but it's possible we might need you on the phone to do. Harry's already on the phone, Susan Silverdale as well. But just keep it in mind, this is a thick chapter, and as I said earlier, I believe it's a two-week chapter. So the chapter four people, which is Simon and Jim, I'll look at your summary tomorrow, and if I have comments, we can take another shot at it. That's chapter four. But right now, we're still in chapter three. So let's dig into this. There's a lot of meat here, and boy, is this good material. It's really material that I think we can take to the bank, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And so let's see what we say here. Okay, so man is the only animal that can pray. There's an enormous tradition behind about prayer in the Western, mystical tradition, certainly, and in the depths of the great studies, the huge studies done by both in the Western Orthodox tradition and the wonderful mystical body of knowledge produced by the Desert Fathers in the Eastern Orthodox material, mm-hmm. the Philokalia, and just a delightful little book The Way of the Pilgrim. Harry, is that a book that you would you've been to a little bit, The Way of the Pilgrim, and The Pilgrim Continues His Way?
I have read that many years ago. I think it's an excellent book.
It's an excellent book which poses the question right at the very beginning, the pilgrims, and I don't believe, if I remember correctly, we don't ever hear his name.
That's correct, if I remember.
Yeah, which is common in a lot of the mystical literature. They're going, so what? My name is unimportant. My story I'm sharing only because it helps you on the path. And this pilgrim...
Actually, it was written by two different people, according to some scholars I've read who say the writing style indicates two authors.
Okay, that's interesting. So the pilgrim begins, not important to the detail, but he's entranced by this phrase in the Bible that says, pray always. And he says, well, this can't be. How can you possibly pray always? Because you got to go to work, you got to take care of the kids, you got to repair the car, you have to, in one of the cases he puts, you might have to argue a case in court. How can you pray always? It just can't be. Okay. Let's see what this chapter has to say about that comment and that term, pray always. All right, let's see what we get. If he can pray, he ought to pray. And we're using a term here, for you philosophers, you know that the term ought is an enormously important word in that literature of philosophy, should and ought, that you ought to. So here it's saying, if you have this skill, if you have this ability, we won't raise it to the level of skill quite yet, okay? It's just an ability. If you have the ability, you ought to do it. He is intended to. He was intended to. Of course, by man, I do not mean the organic human being. And as Silverdale has instructed us at times, we call that the historical personality. We're not talking about that at the moment. Historical personality is quiet at the moment. But a fully transformed, evolved man with an awakened biological machine. For the chatters online, can you just put the from HBM, can you just write into the chat what in the literature of E.J. Gold is meant by an awakened biological machine? What are those techniques to awaken the machine? Can you write that in there? Go ahead. What's his name again?
Ivan.
No, his other name.
Oh.
Huh?
Ivan?
Eigenbite.
Oh.
What does that mean?
Oh.
Eigenbite rules. Why does the absolute... I'm going to continue. You just... Okay. Both what it means and what is a technique. But why does the absolute need prayer? And Simon, if you're on, that, of course, is your conundrum. This question presents us with an important idea about creation, that creation was not voluntary, but it was involuntary. And, you know, in the Hindu tradition, Brahma is sitting there resting on this beautiful, elaborate rug, and there's nothing but Brahma and the void. I think he was on a rug very similar to that, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Hand knotted, for sure.
Hand knotted. And then he decided to manifest, and there was creation. Okay? And so... But in doing so, something happened, and the absolute was attached to this creation. And as we've seen in the tree of life, you know, we are in the coarsest level of that which is called manifestation, right? We're in the very lowest. It's called the world we live in. Okay.
Bottom of the heap.
We're at the bottom of the heap. And then it's not but it's involved in some automatic manifestation of the very being of the Absolute itself. And that in some way the Absolute is crucified upon this involuntary creation. Silverdale, I had your name by that phrase. Is it okay if I ask you to just speak about it for just a moment?
Sure. What particularly?
What would it mean that the Absolute is crucified upon this involuntary creation?
Yeah, you know, if the Absolute existed initially entirely by himself or herself in the whole of the universe and discovered that he was gradually dying, then he had to create a process of reciprocal feeding and maintenance. And I don't know, I always think of that as a kind of a voluntary decision on his part. Here it says it was an involuntary decision, but in any event, the creation sprung into existence once he changed a couple of primordial laws, and now he's enmeshed in his creation because he's feeding the creation and subsequently being fed by his creation as well. So he's really crucified on that cross of his creation. He can't escape it.
It's of his own making, in a sense. He's made his field upon which now, what have I done? Here's what it is. It's called creation. And then jumping ahead, we know, into that, the very bottom, we also know that in some way, prayer is helpful to the Absolute, even though the Absolute can never really escape the crucifixion. Somehow, prayer is helpful to the Absolute. And then, you know, the life of Jesus is sadly misunderstood. Crucifixion is not a means of pain for the sins of the world. Far from it. It is a message, a graphic illustration of the plight of the Absolute, who is in reality behind the man on the cross. So instead of, gosh, Jesus died for our sins, and somehow that's exactly like, because that entity died for our sins, now that solves everything. This makes much more sense to me, that it's a symbolic representation of what in fact is there, is that the Absolute, which is represented in the form called we call it, you know, Jesus or the Kippurath, you know, had no escape. Creation is endless in the sense that it is eternal. Just as our lives are also eternal because they must exist within creation, axiomatic. And the man on the cross, although existing historically within creation, is a reflection of the real event that exists completely outside of space and time. That's just a little, that's philosophical, and it's important to know. And then in the next paragraph he goes on that the oldest form of prayer was not supplication. So let us talk a moment about what is supplication. What do we understand by that? Do you want to take a shot at that?
I'd say it's begging for something. Supplication is asking in the highest form or grossest form for something that is needed by the petitioner. That's kind of my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
At some place, begging.
Begging. Susan? Susan, are you on?
I'm here. I would say, yes, it's asking for something.
Asking for something. So I'm going outside myself. Okay. There's the mechanism of two. What we're concerned with here is the mechanism of these processes. if we're going outside ourselves, saying, I want you to give me, or I'd like you to do this. That's, and in the supplication, we can see that there's a process. Yes, it's begging, it's asking for something, so on and so forth, but there's also this mechanism that I'm trying to get to. It's that can give me this,
mm-hmm.
or I will do this for you.
If you do that for me.
Whatever it is, or some
yeah.
of the high prayers are also don't have that in, that involved. It's not like they want anything. They're just praying to the Father, the Son, Spirit.
Well, adoration is a form of prayer that's used. You know, if they're not asking for
yep.
something, then they're glorifying the name or the entity or raising its ego up a little bit.
and we therefore have to be careful in a case like that. So Hawk Lady is saying it's giving power away. And this is a fundamental part of what we will be getting into in this chapter. It's a critical part of it.
Yeah, Mark says it's also needing, also putting ourselves at the mercy of what we are supplicating to. And John says it's duality characterized.
So, and duality, as Tianjia is saying, is an evidence of it, and that's part of what I'm getting to, is that there's a duality in this case. And as Mark, what is Mark saying again?
It's also putting ourselves at the mercy of what we're
putting ourselves at the mercy.
And Mark arrives that maybe we feel maybe lack.
Okay, so we understand some of those principles, and now let's move on. The original name for the prayer is Alcdonus. Am I saying that even close to being right? Which means helping the Absolute. What kind of prayer helps the Absolute? Not prayer of man asking for help for himself. In real prayer, check this out, we do not pray, we make prayer. That prayer is called prayer absolute. Oh my gosh. What could that even mean? We make prayer? I don't get it. I mean, I know what it means to like make a pie or go out and make money. I do this and so on and so forth. But what does it mean I make prayer?
Well, just in the case of making a pie or making money, that you are involving more than just your head. You're involving your entire being into those particular things that you're doing. So instead of saying prayer strictly out of the head brain, making prayer could be using the entire being.
Okay.
Such as making a pie. You know, you're actually physically doing something and you're creating something as you're doing it.
Prayer is a substance.
So Harry is saying prayer is a actual substance. The actual substance. What does that mean? Like it's a thing? Is it
must be like a pie.
Like a rock? Rock is a substance. Prayer absolute is directed to the absolute, while subjective prayer is directed toward the things of the biological machine. Prayer absolute is a way of paying for personal existence at the same time producing our own possible evolution. So now comes forth this concept of obligation, paying for our existence. Prayer absolute, in the ancient sense of the phrase, is a means by which we can absolve ourselves of original sin. Wow. So these are some enormous concepts that have been laid at our feet here. We make prayer. And Harry, we're coming back to what is a substance, but it's a substance. We make prayer.
Well, David, Lost Orion says prayer absolute equals giving back.
Prayer absolute equals giving back. So there's something about giving back.
Simon ends by remorse of conscience.
So remorse of conscience. Simon says. Now, let's look at the phrase. What's the very last phrase in that paragraph? Absolve ourselves
of original sin.
If original sin is an electron, then prayer is a positron.
Well, do you mean like original sin because Eve ate from the apple? Help me out here, George. Original sin, what's by original sin?
Well, I think what this text is suggesting is that original sin is nothing more than the accumulation of our forgetfulness about our divine origin. So as our historical personality grows over the course of a lifetime, we're accumulating the snowfall of forgetfulness. We become buried under that snowfall. That's the totality of our original sin. Prayer absolute is a means by which we might melt that snow, remember ourselves, and emerge into the clear sunlight.
Oh,
very nice.
We have, what an opportunity we've been given. We have been given the opportunity of existence. It's like, you know, we always hear that here's this great business opportunity you have, right? Take advantage of it. You've got to hurry and take advantage of it.
Yeah.
Well, our existence and the gift we were given was given subtly to us. And, quite frankly, the gift of forgetfulness and the sleep that we were immersed in, that we immersed ourselves in, the sleep of working to develop this human biological machine, for, you know, to survive. I mean, this thing is different than my essential self. We were given the gift of that too. And the sleep, in the sleep itself, in a sense, is the route to the salvation. But it's a difficult thing. We have that. And as Susan knows, is that it's sometimes right in front of our very face, the path to clarity. It's right there. But we didn't see it until we start to get a different perspective on it. So original sin is not some abstract philosophical or religious idea, but a tangible material substance which accumulates in the machine as a result. Here we go, of many passages of our presence in the course of our mechanical return throughout this life. Sin, therefore, in this sense, is one result of our unconscious seduction into organic life. Wow. It's real simple stuff. There's no no morality. We want to put morality on it, right? We want to say, oh, this is really bad. But the second you say that, a whole other thing enters in. So sin is just simply a form of unconsciousness that wherein we were seduced into organic life. That's what it is. We forgot. We forgot. Beautifully put by Silverdale. Beautifully put. And if you have time, George, to go on the, you can refer to these paragraphs on page 18 and 19. And if you could just write what you said, what a gift. And the website is wingsofchaos.com, The Hidden Work. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that there. Thank you for that.
Hey, and by the way, David, if I could turn that coin over, as we engage in, this is out of the kind of the Gurdjieff teaching, as we engage in this prayer absolute, what he says is that we release two material substances. One is Elkdonis and a second substance called Abrastonis. But the point is that material substance, Elkdonis, which arises from prayer absolute, is the material with which we actually are able to crystallize our higher being bodies and thereby participate more fully in the divine life. So that is right. The state of self-remembering our divine nature as opposed to the original sin of forgetting our divine nature, because we're not actually releasing this material substance, Elkdonis, for the formation, creation, and crystallization of a higher being body.
So what these individuals, Harry, George, E.J. Gold, in this book are talking about isn't like, oh, you're really a good person, and therefore you'll get into heaven. It's utterly objective fact. It's objective fact. Have you built up that substance? It's just, is that substance being built up one molecule at a time, one subatomic particle at a time? Or is it occurring? Do you have a sense when you are in a space where that might be accumulating? That's a pragmatic question.
And you know, Dave, just to add one more aspect to take this back to the human biological machine, as we engage in this process, what we discover is there is actually an electrical field within our material body. And it's that electrical field, as it becomes active, as you say, molecule by molecule over a long period of time, as it increases in its intensity, the machine awakens. And so you begin the reciprocal initiative process between a machine that is gradually waking up and this electrical field of the essential self, which is gradually growing as we do.
So these mechanisms are suddenly, rather than being sorry for our sins, and all of us Catholics can remember what it's like to enter into the confessional. And then we're given the task, go say seven Hail Marys and three Our Fathers and do the act of contrition. But I guess in a certain esoteric way, Harry, those are methods of prayer, if we can get to the very depths of those as well. In our work, we should think of sin without guilt, by which we mean that if we have real remorse of conscience, we can use this, that remorse of conscience, as a source of force for a prayer absolute, where we begin to sense in a very active way, we sense the sleep of the machine. Not only do we sense the sleep of the machine, but we sense that we are separate. We are separated from the absolute. We are separated really from our true self, and our true self starts to awaken. That electrical body of the essential self starts to come to alive, and we go, oh, yes. Gosh, I remember what that memory is. It's a, what I call a higher form of nostalgia, where you sense, you begin to sense who you are. And I don't mean this in a, what do you call it, a new age sense of, you know, just start thinking about yourself as being an angelic being, because you really are, you know? You're really an angelic being, and you're really cool. You just have to think that. No, you have to work at it. And that's
David, it seems like this is a transition from where we recognize that first that we are a machine, a biological organism that has an essential self, and later we recognize that we had it backwards, that we're really essential selves who have a biological machine through which to express.
Well said, David. Harry.
Well put. Yes. My gosh. We've got some real...
That's what we remember.
These are the poets that are speaking now, and I hope we get that on the site too, Harry, for everyone to reflect on. And I will put the log up, but these are, that's in the recording, not on the log. So we begin to sense this. Now I want to concentrate at this point, and I'm not sure. How to take this, but I'll just tell you what I want to do, and maybe we can figure it out together. I want to concentrate on the first part now, on what does it mean to perform prayer absolute, okay? Let's see if we can focus more and more on it. Can we study it so that we can come up with a methodology where all of us can go home and say, yeah, I have a good sense of that. I have a good sense. We're not looking for the grand slam home run here. We're looking for something that we can do. Because I want to walk through the day like that pilgrim and says, pray always. Pray always and have a sense that, yes, I am achieving that. I am in prayer, and prayer is on me. Okay? So, the only sure cure for sin is awakening of the machine. Okay, so we understand now we have a different concept of sin altogether, right? Does everybody have a good sense of that? I don't want anybody, Susan and Ivan, I don't want anybody left behind here. I want everybody to have a good sense of that difference in sin. This is not a moral break, but it's the accumulated sleep that we have.
Yeah, they were discussing it online also, that separation, that selfishness, separation, smaller self.
So some of the comments are selfishness, separation, things like that.
Yeah.
Identification.
Identification with the external.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think innocence might have a special meaning a little bit later, Becky. But it's that. So when we're identified in full with a machine, and all we're doing is living in the machine and defending the machine, that's who we are at that time. We are that. Okay, every move we make is prayer. And Becky, remember that when we get to the very, very last paragraph. Okay, that'll be huge. Thy will be done is, for some people, that's the end of it. Some people can use that as a mantra. It's great, 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 strong.
And Vidaria says prayer to movement.
Who is this?
Vidaria.
Vidaria? Can you ask who that is? Okay. So, prayer through movement. And we're going to expand on that. Okay. Thank you, Kathleen. So, the sin then is immersion in the sleep of the machine. And as long as we are immersed in that, we are in that state called sin. That's all it is. Really, it's another word for not awake. Mm-hmm. Okay? But in order to do and get to some of our positioning of the obligation and opportunity we have before us, we have to work with the awakened machine. That's the beginning of the work. That's not the end of it. Awakening the machine isn't the end of this. It's the beginning of it. So, cure for the sin is awakening of the machine and the resulting transformation of the being so that we are able to return consciously to our life, our time, for the perfection of the inner qualities. Here we go. These are the inner qualities. Attention, presence, and consciousness. And being, working from the present to the past, earlier and earlier, until finally we're able to work on its perfection from the very beginning to the very end, then I am the Alpha and the Omega. And it's you rediscover and recapture all of that. That's there at the end, too. Are there any questions on that point? Yeah.
Aria has a comment.
Okay.
We carry our sin / baggage everywhere we go. It emanates out of us, around us, and it clouds our perspective.
Exactly. And so at some point, to repeat what Simon says, as we begin to actually see that, the first part of it is this developing this true remorse of conscience, where our conscience awakens to the fact that, wait a minute, I've been given this divine gift of opportunity, and that's upon me. And suddenly, can I use it? Because I have a great obligation before me. Simon is asking why from the present to the past. So let's explore that a little bit. That's worth exploring in terms of this process of prayer. I'm just going to throw a phrase out, but I'll need help from Harry and George on this one too. It's we're recapturing our life in a sense. We're going back and re-alivening it. We're recalling our essential self. And I mean, that's I'm just saying in this present life, but then there's another form of it too. George?
Yeah, you know, first of all, let me say that I've always had difficulty with the idea of trying to go back and or with the idea of, let me start again. I accept that there's a possibility that we relive this same life over and over and over again, and it's important to awaken consciously in this life so that when we return to this life, we're more awakened to begin with and can make quicker progress. But personally, to make this a practical application, I actually read this as every breath we take is the beginning of our life and the end of our life in one inhalation and exhalation. And so if we can perfect our life in each breath, then we gradually end up improving our past as well, even though it's already evaporated. So I'm not particularly clear, but I'm not saying that as particularly clearly. But for me, when it says we return to this life, I interpret that to be with each breath we are born and die.
Okay.
See that? Yeah.
Okay.
David, I had a comment I'd like to share, if I might. One of my teachers had me on this going into the past. He said, you pray constantly, as it says in Thessalonians, to pray consistently and constantly. You can only do this if you realize that if you were in the king's presence, you could wash dishes, and you would be aware the king was there. But if you were asked to pray, you could do that the same way as you would wash dishes. You would know all the time that the king was there. And as you expand the presence of the king from the room you're in to the community where you're living, and maybe to the country, and maybe to the globe, and then you go into your past, and that's how you redeem your past. So, and you do your future the same way. He would constantly expand the meditation of the presence of the king everywhere I went, even into the past, so that it would kind of re-imprint it in a different way for me.
I'm gonna experiment a little bit with taking it literally. Okay? Literally in this lifetime. And yeah, the concept of eternal recurrence is what George was implying as well. Recapitulation, probably Simon, I think he knows that literature well. But my comment is this, as in the present, as my presence becomes more expansive and prayer absolute becomes more an everyday occurrence in my life, I suddenly look back and I realize moments when I rose to the level of prayer absolute many times during my life. And those times were shanghaied by the sleep of the machine. They were taken by it and they were reinterpreted as this or that because there was no context. There was no context. I am creating context, and to the extent that I can be in this thing called prayer absolute, at the foot of the moment of creating the substance that Harry is referring to, and R.C. did this, take a look at the summary they did on chapter 3, quite enlightening. I actually see myself capturing it back. And as I do that, and I capture these moments, even right now as I'm reflecting back on my past, I'm remembering many of these moments. They were just moments of lucidity, but also moments when I think I was touching that place called prayer absolute. And I wonder sometimes, Harry, if I can re-enliven those moments, am I capturing substance even from those times now? Vividly.
Oh, I think that's exactly what we're doing.
I think that's exactly what we're doing, Harry tells us. And right now, if I'll give one example, and I've shared this example many times in the course of the last few years, is that when I was, for some reason, my sister and I were in church, Catholic church, by ourselves. It's an empty church, and if you've ever been to a Catholic church, that's a little spooky to begin with. But we're in there in this awe, and this, the grandeur of the church is there. Five or six rows in front of us was a single man quietly praying. And he continued to pray, and we were just wide-eyed. We didn't know what to do. I guess we were just told, go in there and wait. Okay, or something like that. And then after a while, we're imbued with this sense of being in this space. After a while, this man in front of us He leans back and his arms outfold, and he just leans back in a form of devotion. At that moment, I saw devotion directly. I was 9 years old. That has almost as much power today as it did then. And there are many examples. So I'm not quite sure either what, you know, Simon, it means going from the present to the past, but that's the offerings that our class, our group right here, gave each other. Okay? But if we return to our lives unconsciously, how can we study the life for possible perfection? It's only when we begin to study it. And Susan, I want to share some, no details, but I want to share a little bit about our conversation early this afternoon. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, that's fine.
We were having a conversation about a process that she was going through, and actually had applied, I don't know if Aria is here tonight. Oh, yeah, I guess she is. Yeah, and it applies to something that she and I talked about over the weekend, too, is that Susan was going through this process, and really it was a form of, in a form of duality, saying, that other person, that other person, that other person. But I got the powerful sense that when she looks at herself, she will find this thing here, life, possible perfection. In that process that she discovered, it was unconscious before. In a way, it was bothersome to her. But when she'll now look at it, her attention, presence, and consciousness will rest on that process. It's a mechanical process.
Mm-hmm.
And when it rests on it, not only will it will begin to transform. There's a process that occurs. It'll begin to transform. And behind it, Susan, I believe you will find a creativity that you will be able to offer into the situation that simply wasn't there before. It's waiting to come out in a sense. Does that ring at all true?
Well, it does, and also just I think it changes the perspective when I bring it back to myself.
Yeah. Because as Hawk Lady was saying, that we are powerless when we pray to something outside us. But when we look and we say, okay, that's what's in me, at that point, you have a chance, don't you? Don't you have some chance?
Well, I wanted to say, going back to present to the past,
this
relates along in that line, what we're talking about now, we only have the machine to work with. So we have to go present to past. When we're not around, we can't work on it.
Okay.
So we have to be in the machine to work on it.
Okay, that's a very simple but profound way of looking at that concept.
So when Susan was bringing it back to herself, she's bringing it back to her own presence, her own machine-ness, and working on it from there, and that's the place to have to.
And I think another concept, a very good, exactly put in there, is that Susan had the will to look at it, too.
Mm-hmm.
She had the will.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are the tools we have. That's part of our toolkit.
She wouldn't have had any will had she not taken on some training in the past, because will, that kind of will just doesn't come to people. They don't want to.
She created
they don't
that.
Want
That's
to do
exactly
that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is evidence of the substance that Harry's telling us about.
It shows you how different will is from desire.
Very different. Yeah, very different. Like, if I'm a parakeet, I desire little food seeds, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's automatic. That's how that one works. But will is to do is something different. It's to free ourselves. It's the will to begin to take on this obligation. And I don't think we're going to get through the whole chapter, but certainly the next part of it, I want to concentrate on this idea of obligation. And R.C., at the very bottom of page 19, I'm not ready to quite go there yet, but let's just continue, okay? I'll stop talking.
Aria commented on the...
Yeah, go ahead.
I often see myself in others and see my past behaviors mirrored in others and think, wow, huh, I'll bet this is how I looked when I was manifesting the other time.
Oops.
What was that? I didn't get
it. She said that, was this Aria?
Yeah.
Aria. That's funny. She sees other people manifesting. She sees herself in that manifestation and goes, oh, wow, I wonder if that's how I looked when I was manifesting. Yeah. The answer
that's
is
really
yes.
Wonderful that she can look in that way. That's outside of herself. That's a little bit, that's pretty good.
And Aria, as we know, is a teacher teaching young children, young kids, not super young, but she went through a breakthrough because, I believe because in part, she accepted the obligation of herself and started looking in herself, and that's when she began to see a creativity and manifested that creativity, and then the class changes.
Wonderful. That's so wonderful.
All right? So how we manifest internally, and it has to come from within, from these attention, presence, and consciousness, so that the being begins to reach its handout, to reach its handout into the world, rather than we react all the time to that which is around us. If at the moment of entry into this life we had the will to awaken the machine, we would not be subject to sleep of the machine. We could easily study the imperfection of our inner lives and repair them with the radiations of our being produced by the awakening of the machine from the first moment of conception. But how can we awaken the machine? To begin with, we cannot awaken the machine until we know it is asleep. Back to Spinoza. Spinoza says that we would gain nothing. He doesn't have this terminology because in the 17th century they used a different terminology. But in essence, he is saying we couldn't awaken unless we had, as he puts it, imperfections. And then because he says you see the imperfections, and as he put it in one letter to Oldenburg, Klaus Oldenburg, his friend, he says, every once in a while I happen upon an imperfection and I delight, because I know I can go up yet further. So the sleep of the machine in itself is a barrier, but it also provides us with a tool, and it's a tool for awakening. But we have to look around us, and it's only by having the lever of the awakened being, when we have that, then we can begin to want to do that, and that's where I think Susan wound up today, is this will was just burning in her, and with great passion she comes forth with it. So, once again, how do you repair the machine? Let's just spend the last couple of minutes on this. How do you repair the machine again? What is that concept? Is that being discussed at all, or let's discuss that a bit? I'm asking that as a question. How do you repair the machine? And repair them with the radiations of our being. How do you do it? Becky, how do you do it? Or what do you mean by that? I can't remember her name. Anna? Kathleen. Simon. Jim.
Becky says that maybe repairing the machine is by not looking for faults in others.
Okay, so Becky says don't look for faults in others, and maybe that's how you repair the machine. Well, in order to do that, then you have to suspend your judgment about those behaviors. Truly suspend it. Not say, oh, I'm not going to judge that creep over there for being such a creep. No, you actually have to come to a moment of objectivity. And to come to a moment of objectivity, guess what? You have to awaken your machine. That's the process. Okay, you have to work to awaken it. And then in these hidden eddies and coves of asleepness. So Jim is very simple. He says, observe the machine. And is that not what we did a little bit work on today, Susan?
Observe. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. And so that's, what do you observe it with, Jim? What are you talking about? Observe the machine. When I said to my father, I was 19 years old, and I was so excited about this concept of know thyself, I come to the table, and he goes, I know myself. I'm the guy that's here talking to you.
That was an answer.
Yeah, that was an answer. It probably took me 20 years to recover from. What do you... Okay. Those are both important ideas, this cleansing radiation, but hold on tight to the what? Presence. Yeah. But what is it? Where does the observation of the machine come from? What the heck do you mean?
Mark says to keep invoking presence so that the machine energies can merge more with and be healed by the essential self.
Okay. The attention, where does that attention, from whence does it come? It doesn't come from the machine if we're observing the machine, right? Susan, where did it come from? Where does it come from? Aria. Jim, where does that attention, what is that attention?
Jim says the observer of the essential self.
So the observer of the essential, is the essential self? Of the essential self. The observer is the essential self. So suddenly, if George is telling us that we discover this new electrical body called the essential self, and that comes forth, and suddenly it looks at the machine, and it sees something. It sees this, not crystallized, but purged behavior of the machine. Okay? Well, we didn't get very far, M.A.
Well, we knew it was going to be a meaty chapter.
Yeah.
It is. Pretty meaty.
But I want to, in the next paragraph it says, in addition, we can only awaken the machine in its lifetime. Then it says, voluntarily ascending the cross. For some reason, Hawk Lady, I wrote your name down next to that phrase, ascending the cross. So maybe next week, that's where we will begin. And did Hawk Lady get that? I'll be asking that question at the beginning of next class, Hawk Lady. It's right in the dictionary, too. You can just look it up. I think it's in Wikipedia.
Well, she says she's there.
I know she is. That's why I asked. Well, my goodness. That was the quickest hour I think I've ever had.
Yeah, went by fast.
That was... Is that clock right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it 1 hour already?
Yeah.
That was remarkable.
Amazing.
That's part one of chapter three. And I appreciate everybody coming, and I hope I didn't blather on too much and left some room for commentary. Good.
A great class, David and Marianne. Thank you.
Harry
thank
and
you.
George and Harry, thank you so much for your contributions. And Susan, thanks for everything, okay?
Glad you guys are all online tonight and being with us.
Yeah, so we have a big hurdle to get through this chapter next week. So we'll put on our thinking skulls and see where we get.
Uh-huh.
So thank you again, and we'll see you next week. Good
next
night.
Next week.
Good night.